Welcome to the Maria Heller Show. On the net since 2000 and still going strong. If you feel like you're not getting the real news, if you feel like you're not connected spiritually, you have found your home. Maria covers a wide range of topics as only a snarky New Yorker can. Straight up, no chaser. No censorship, no corporate sponsors, thus true freedom of speech. Your subscription gives you unlimited access as a member of the smartest audience on earth. Relax and enjoy the education. Now here's Maria.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to the show. Before I introduce my guest, just a reminder, tomorrow's new show will be late because I'll be on Richie Allen's show in the UK at 10 o'clock Pacific time. So if you want to tune in and support Richie's work, absolutely do. And the news, of course, will follow after that. So I'll be all talked out. Anyway, let me tell you about my guest today. He's been on the show before with his super excellent book, Survival of the Richest, and 3 days ago, I got his newest book, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, between the years 1776 and 1963, the history they didn't teach you in school. I got it 3 days ago, and I'm more than halfway through the book. And of course, the author, Donald Jeffries. You've heard me talk about this book on the show already. So I'm really happy to have Donald Jeffries back with me. Good morning, Donald.
How you doing, Maria? Great to be back with you.
I'm doing okay. I have to tell you, very rarely this type of book, okay, a history book basically, is not a book that I would ever use the word, it's spellbounding. And yet that's the word that I find this book to be.
Wow, that's wonderful. I'm so appreciative of all your support, and I hope others agree with you. I try to make it as interesting as I can when I'm writing about these things and try to have a little bit of a sense of humor. But, you know, naturally, you're pointing, I think if you're curious, as you are, and you have an open mind, and, you know, you're awake, which a lot of people aren't, unfortunately, then you're receptive to this, and it should be spellbinding to learn these things that most Americans don't know.
Right, right. But listen, most Americans don't know because we were never taught. And we were just taught basically, you know, revisionist history. But I did want to let you know that I immediately went in after, you know, beginning maybe the first two chapters or so. I went over to Amazon to review the book and they kicked back my review. I looked at their supposed rules of why it was kicked back, and the only reason I could figure it out was I had listed my website there. And as you know, I'm constantly blackballed from social media. So I went in and redid it this morning without my website. So we'll see if they accept that, you know. Then, and it's crazy because, I mean, if I order vitamins on Amazon, they ask me to review it, and I always do. So that's just another little aside. So I'm not going to jump to the conclusion that it was, you know, me being stricken because it was a good review. But I did want to let you know that in case some of your other reviews don't show up there.
Well, that's wonderful. I appreciate that.
All right.
They will show up.
All right. So, you know, you may or may not know, because I'm not sure that I knew you or knew of your work when I was co-hosting my show with Dave McGowan. And Dave was a co-host on my show for 14 years. And, you know, right before he died, Dave started working on the Lincoln assassination. And unfortunately, he never got to finish it. So when I picked up your book, I was like, wow, okay, Donald's picking it up where David left off. So I want to thank you for that.
Oh, well, you know how I feel about Dave McGowan. I envy you that you knew him so well, because I just started reaching out to him. We had exchanged a couple emails, and I feel confident, you know, we would have become good cyber buddies if he had not so died so tragically young. But I love his stuff, and you know, I mention him in the book. I credit him, and right now I'm writing a book on show business, and I credit him quite a bit because I use his Laurel Canyon book a lot.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great resource, and he was one of a kind, and he's, when people have compared me, you're not the only one that has compared me to him, and I'm incredibly flattered to be compared to someone. I think he was a great writer, and he had so much.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize how smart Dave was. You know, he was a Mensa student. I mean, this guy's brilliance was off the charts. Plus,
incredibly funny. He was
right.
Just, I was out loud when you're reading.
Listen, we have so many laughs in the archives that he and I would just laugh at the news together. And it was amazing because there were days I'd call him for our show and he'd say, wow, I forgot all about it. I don't have anything prepared. I said, let's do it anyway. And those were some of our best shows, just going off the cuff.
Right.
So I'm very thankful that you mentioned Dave in your book as much as you do. And I'm also thankful that you mentioned me in your acknowledgments, which is something that a lot of writers and people I've had on my show the 20 years, they kind of forget where they got their start, and it kind of hurts me. You know, when they send me a new book, the first thing I do is look in the glossary to see if my show is listed. 90% of the time, it's not.
Well, I had to acknowledge you for your, you know, sometimes I feel like you're the only one that's talking about Survival of the Richest, because that's kind of been my forgotten book out of everything I've written, but you have promoted it relentlessly.
I still promote it because, listen, we're living in a time where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting screwed.
Absolutely.
You know, we have nothing but a criminal administration making money off the presidency, and everybody acts like this is a normal thing. And I'm sitting back, and as I start reading your book, what I realize is it is normal, and it has been normal since George Washington.
Exactly. Well, you know, I learned so many things while writing this book that I pride myself on being, a great student of history, but especially hidden history. But there were a few things I learned. I unearthed a quote from William Henry Harrison, who nobody knows very much about this guy. He's famous for mainly being the shortest tenured president. He served 32 days. You know, he died after supposedly contracting pneumonia, standing out in the freezing rain, and so forth. But he left that great quote on the record that I put in the book that said something like, after a lifetime of public service, I've come to realize that everything the government does is to make the rich richer and the poor poorer.
Right. Exactly.
That's profound.
Listen, I grew up with a Sicilian mother. You know what she used to say all the time? She said, the rich get richer and the poor get screwed.
Well, that's one of those old chestnuts that I think anybody outside. Well, I guess if you're a one percenter, you kind of scoff at it. But for the rest of us, we realize how true that old chestnut is.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember, you know, with Trump's millionaire tax cut, you know, how he said we were all going to get a check for $4,000. I'm still waiting for that check.
Well, that's always, you know, they always talk about the middle class. They're always talking to the middle class, which largely doesn't exist now, thanks to their policies. But because I think most of us, even if you're poor, you kind of hope, oh, I'm kind of middle class. You know, you hope they're talking to you. And so they always sell it like that. They never sell it, well, you know, the rich really need another tax break, because that's what always happens.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they sell it as a middle class tax cut. And you're right, the middle class is still waiting for that tax cut. And I don't know what kind of middle class is getting it, but it's not.
Well, we're already $4 trillion more debt on America, which is supposedly comes out to about $76,000 per person in America. And I don't understand, you know, why the Democrats are just sitting on their hands. I'm like, what else is it going to take to stop the madness? But when I read your book and I see that, you know, people way back when, before the Federalists came in, were already disgusted with the two-party system. So nothing really has changed.
No, I mean, I'm a populist. I mean, that's, you know, my hero's Huey Long, but I write in this book a lot about William Jennings Bryan, who was another populist who influenced Huey Long and who's been largely forgotten, even though he was a three-time nominee of the Democratic Party for president.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the American people and their infinite wisdom back then, you know, didn't vote him in any of those three times, but he comes off great in reading of history, especially compared to a lot of the other establishment liberals of his era. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, who was, I have his quotes on the record, I mean, if anybody was a racist at that time, this guy was a vile racist against almost everybody. I mean, he left so many ugly quotes, and I've got them in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he also was a big warmonger. I mean, he supported every war there ever was, where William Jennings Bryan was a genuine pacifist and wanted to resign as Wilson's Secretary of State over World War I. And then he was smeared by Hollywood in that movie Inherit the Wind, where Frederick March plays him as a doddering Bible thumper, Christian fundamentalist who gets, you know, taken to task by Spencer Tracy's heroic Clarence Darrow, who Clarence Darrow in real life was a eugenicist, a war lover, and who was also corrupt. He was bribing jurors and got off, the only reason he got off was by Hollywood's, one of their big mob lawyers. They got all the stars off. They got him off as well. But William Jennings Bryan, in reality, was no Christian fundamentalist Bible thumper. He objected to evolution on the basis of the survival of the fittest. He thought that this would result in the kind of eugenicist that we see in all those guys, including Clarence Darrow. He was worried that that kind of thinking would cause people to, let's weed out the people that aren't quite as good. And we know, you know, from my earlier writing, that these people, especially on the left, even people I love, like George Bernard Shaw and Nikola Tesla, H.G. Wells, people like that, they were eugenicists. And they really thought, hey, we have to stop the lower classes from breeding. And this is they believe, and it's...
Well, it's very Hitler-like.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly what they ascribed to Hitler. And so they really should have been on board the Nazis, because, you know, whatever he did, it was in line with their thinking.
Right. Well, it certainly looks like it's in alignment with Trump's thinking, too. You know, listen, when I review books, Donald, you know, sometimes I'm reading the book, used to be like a month before I'd have the author on. So I would always make little notations in the margins. I have almost written as many notations in the margins of your book as you have written the book. Okay. I'm like, oh my God, whoever looks at this book is going to say, what a mess. But, you know, when people ask, and it's a generalization because of the lies we've been told, which always reminds me of the one day, you know, David really woke up to something we were talking about. I don't even remember what the topic, because we went through so much stuff. And, you know, up to that point, Dave McGowan was pretty cool, calm, and collected. But he just blurts out on the show. He says, everything I ever learned in my life was a fucking lie. And he was just, he blew himself away. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when you ask people the generalization, the general public, you know, who's your favorite president? Who are they going to throw out at us? They're going to throw out Washington. They're going to throw out Lincoln. Yeah. Because of the way we've been mind controlled. But when people ask me, I've always said since high school, Thomas Jefferson. I don't think we've ever had a statesman or a president as brilliant as Thomas Jefferson, as good as Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, we had a big statue of Jefferson in the lobby of my high school, because it was Jefferson High School. And every day I'd pass that statue and I would see on the bottom of the statue his quote, "To thine own self be true." And, you know, it got through, obviously it got through to me. Heavy duty, you know, because I just do what I feel is right for me. So, you know, when you look at, you know, how they blow smoke up these presidents that were racist, warmongering, bloodsuckers, it amazes me that how few people are willing to even read a book.
Yeah, and Thomas Jefferson, the reason I wrote so much in defense of him, and not only because I've always loved him, I even as a little kid, I think, you know, on that basis, because my name is Jeffries, his name was close enough to mine where he was the only famous person I had heard of to that extent that had a name that was close to mine. So, you know, in like an immature way, I just kind of, oh, the Jefferson, you know.
All right.
But when I started realizing how brilliant he was, and his words are still so stirring, so it irritates me to know, and as you mentioned, by today's standards, every white man alive in his era would be considered racist, would be considered members of the Ku Klux Klan. That's just the tenor of the times. Mm-hmm. But Jefferson stood out. He was the most enlightened man of his time. So to call him a racist, what are you saying about all the others? And it's, you know, he actually, I put in there about how, you know, he had a very strong passage condemning the slave trade that he wanted that was taken out of the Declaration of Independence, and yes, he was a slave owner, but I also tried to explain that there were a couple reasons why he didn't free his slaves at his death. One, Jefferson had some unfortunate failings. He was a flawed human being personally. He was irresponsible, though he wrote great stuff, and he understood about the money, and he understood how corrupted evil banks could be. He, as a individual, he was very generous, and he tended to spend quite a bit, and he didn't watch his money carefully, so he was always in financial difficulty. So he kind of needed that slave system. And he also had an idea. He had a proposal for gradual emancipation, which was really the only logical way to do it, because what happened is when the slaves were freed, really just on a very crass political pragmatic move by Lincoln, who really didn't care if the slaves were freed or not, as his quotes show, it was akin to throwing them in the deep end of the pool. They had been forbidden to read and write mm-hmm. for their lives. They had no education at all. They were going to be despised, especially by the Southern population, who saw that although only about 5% of Southerners ever owned slaves, the other 95%, just by the master-slave relationship, considered themselves superior. So to suddenly throw all these people into the fire and expect them to be accepted as equals, not right. to mention with the ironclad, the military occupation of the South, the Reconstruction, it was a disaster waiting to happen. And what happened is Ron Paul, who I'm very grateful wrote the foreword to this book, as he said, it set the table for 100 years of terrible race relations, and really real racism kicked in after the Civil War because of Reconstruction, because that's when you got the idea of lynching blacks and all that. I don't think that would have ever come to mind before that. I think it was because of the Reconstruction era, the way it was done, and you had those reactionary policies, awful draconian things like the Jim Crow laws, which were bound to explode, as Langston Hughes said, and they did
right.
eventually explode. But we're still paying the price for that.
Well, look at our prison population. Okay,
exactly, yes.
Slavery still exists in this country, just in a different form. And you look at what you just said about, just releasing these slaves into the wild, basically. And, all I could think of was, these immigrants coming through, after they torture them in an ICE center, how they're just dumping them, in different cities in the country and, fend for yourself. I have to tell you, most of the things that I was comparing almost every other sentence in your book to was something that Trump is doing. So I was kind of surprised that when you compared certain things to George W. Bush or to Bill Clinton, which, of course, I agreed that Trump was missing, because I was like, oh, my God, every page in this book is like this Trump administration.
Well, the book actually was this book was completed a while back. So it's been sitting there for a while, and really, I probably completed it largely before Trump was elected.
I should have get a rubber stamp that just says Trump, so I don't have to keep writing it in the margins.
He's the latest in line. Where
of course,
and the reason why I talk so much about Lincoln is because, and I mentioned you're all the way to George W. Bush, where he used the awful precedents Lincoln set. For the tyranny put Americans under when he threw all the Northerners that opposed his policies into jails, suspended the writ of habeas corpus,
right.
shut down hundreds of newspapers, all the stuff he did, he set awful precedents that were used later during
Absolutely.
World War I, World War II, and all the way through George W. Bush to justify the treatment of the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. Now we know Trump supports that torture, wants to bring it back. So none of it, I don't think, would have been possible, because I think the way why Lincoln is so important, he's a central theme of my book, is because prior to Lincoln, Lincoln was the 16th president. The 15 presidents before Lincoln, if you take out Polk, and Polk, of course, is ranked high by the court historians, too, because he was a war president. They love all the war presidents. Polk provoked that war with Mexico, and there's an example, and Lincoln from the House of Representatives floor opposed it on the same grounds he should have opposed his war on the South, but look at what has happened because of that.
Right.
We still have problems with groups like La Raza and so forth because they have a point. We did take part
exactly.
of Mexico. So these things have consequences,
right.
later. But it was because Polk overstepped his constitutional grounds. Now, until Lincoln, the other 14 presidents, regardless of what you think of them, some were better than others, I was no Federalist, so I didn't really like most of the Federalist presidents. I was on the Jeffersonian side of the debate, the early Democrats. But no matter what, even the Adamses, with the exception of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which again were later used by Woodrow Wilson during World War One to throw Eugene Debs and people like that into prison who protested World War One. With the exception of that, they pretty much followed their constitutional roles, and they didn't step outside their boundaries. They understood the separation of powers. Lincoln obliterated that.
Right.
He tread all over the separation of powers, and he did not think that his authority ended. I mean, we're at war. We must save the Union, and he used that as an excuse for everything. And even today, every historian, with the exception of people like me, Thomas DiLorenzo, a few other renegades, they're all still justifying everything Lincoln did, and it set an awful precedent, and it resulted in the kind of presidents we've seen all the way down through Donald Trump.
Absolutely. You know, when George W., who I thought at the time was the idiot king, when he rolled out the Patriot Act, when he was doing all those things that you just mentioned that Lincoln did, I was reporting it on my show. Abraham Lincoln did the exact same things that George Bush is doing. But, you know, unfortunately, the majority of America doesn't want to hear it. They don't want their myths blown out of the water. Even though we're suffering under it, they still choose to ignore it.
Yeah, and it's ironic because you have some genuinely, I think, with few exceptions, the founding fathers were really an exceptional lot, because the reason I talk about them so much, with the exception of Hamilton, who is the only one they still like, and now has become a hip black star on Broadway, and I don't think there's any accident that he happened to be the banker's favorite founding father, and he fought for a central bank, and he invented debt, lots of disastrous things like that. So he's popular, but the rest of them, they don't like so much. But, and it's really because they set out, I think, as perfect a form of government as can be devised under those separations of power. The problem is, especially once Lincoln got in there, even before Lincoln, John Marshall circumvented the sort of separation of powers, is when the judicial branch took on really a kind of a role-making, a role that they weren't, Jefferson certainly would have opposed it. So that was a disaster to begin with, but when the executive branch, when Lincoln became the first imperial president and set the tone for all the imperial presidencies to come, he really obliterated the three branches, and the legislative branch is the one branch we're closest to, and we see even today.
Yeah, there's no separation.
Congress that is lame and doesn't do what it needs to do, because they are the weakest branch of the government.
Absolutely, and believe me, it's super frustrating to me. It's like, what else does this guy have to do, you know? But maybe back in the day, you know, think about Lincoln and whatnot. You know, they didn't have the kind of information in seconds like we have today. You know, they didn't have the internet. They didn't have, you know, daily newspapers. So, you know, I could kind of forgive people back then for not knowing what was going on. But how can people claim ignorance in 2019?
Well, that's true. But I think we're dealing with, you know, now well over a century of people being dumbed down, and it's kind of a wrong time for me to be writing history books,
right,
for anyone to be doing it, because Americans are largely historically illiterate. So when I write about these things, first of all, you have to hope that the reader understands the conventional, the fake history.
Right.
And a lot of them don't even understand that. They don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh,
so
God.
It's hard to show them how they've been lied to if they don't even know the lie.
Exactly. You know, you had somewhere in the book where you were talking about that time period where you said something like 30 or 35% of the population was illiterate then. And it just was so weird, because my granddaughter's staying with me, and she and one of my friends and I were sitting outside, and she said that she had read somewhere that 60% of Americans are illiterate. So, of course, we all decided we're going to Google this and see what the truth is, right? So the truth of the matter is, scary as it seems, in 2019, 30% of Americans are illiterate. So I said, well, so nothing's changed from Donald's book.
So we've come full circle.
Right. Now I understand the 35% that backs Trump, okay? I said, okay, 30% of them are illiterate. We'll say the other 5% as his family. But yeah, let's get back a little bit to Thomas Jefferson. And I want my listeners and my subscribers, go in into the archives, August 10th, 2007. I don't know if you're familiar, Donald, with Eric Peterson and the work that he did on Jefferson alone.
It sounds familiar, but I didn't read
he
it.
Let's see what the name of the book was. Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness by Thomas Jefferson. And I have to tell you, when I got his book, I was looking at it and I was like, yeah, I don't want to read this. And then one afternoon I says, you know, I'm tired. I need something that's going to put me to sleep. So I hate to say that, but it's true. So I started to read the book, hoping it would knock me out, because what he did is he took all Jefferson's quotes and he put them together in separate chapters on topics. It's an excellent book. And needless to say, I didn't nap. I read the whole book. Okay. When I got Eric on the show, and he was a really nice gentleman, the biggest compliment, and I've gotten a lot of compliments on my show through the years, Donald, but the author of this said that your show, Maria, is very Jeffersonian in nature. He said if Jefferson was alive today, he'd be doing exactly what you're doing.
You could have him as a guest.
I know. I would love to have him as a guest. But for me, that was such a huge compliment because, unlike the rest of America, I know what Thomas Jefferson was. I don't buy all the, oh, he was a racist, he owned slaves, blah, blah, blah. Who didn't in those days, okay? That's right, like saying, right. You know, oh, back in the day, everybody was using cell phones. But, you know, the people forget, and I think Ron Paul's foreword mentions that Jefferson's first draft of the Declaration of Independence condemned slavery. You know, but I guess he wasn't allowed to put it out there that way because everybody else was slavers and racists.
Right. And because of the way to get, and you know how I feel about the left, because I should be on the left, but I'm not welcome there anymore because it's been taken over by this identity politics, which I hate. And we see it in something like the way the left should be loving. Huey Long should be their all-time hero, and you know they don't like him.
Right.
They should love William Jennings Bryan, and they should love Jefferson, who's the most enlightened man of our we've ever had. He's probably the greatest American intellectually.
Even spiritually, statement. His spirituality was leagues ahead of everybody else.
Yes, he was just he was a Renaissance man, and as you know, John F. Kennedy said in the White House when he had all those artists, and he said this is the greatest assemblage of talent the White House has ever seen, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. And he, you know, that's how somebody, JFK, one of the last great liberals,
right,
saw Thomas Jefferson. The left today. Doesn't, with possible exceptions, people like Naomi Wolf, Cynthia McKinney,
Hey, I don't consider myself left, right, or anything. I just consider myself a thinking person. I am left-handed. Well, that's as far as it goes.
Yeah. Well, me neither. I'm not. But I mean, if you look at where my most of my philosophy falls, probably far left. Although I stray over to the far right too. But something like Jefferson. They look at it, and even something like the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which they should be sacred to the left, but it's not to them,
right.
Because the only thing they pay attention to in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution is, well, all men are created equal.
Right.
You know, what about the slaves? They were a fraction of a human being. Okay, we understand that, but that's where their discussion closes down. Period.
They don't
look at the greater. You know, these people were talking about. You know, greater issues philosophically about that all. I mean, and that's why I think Lincoln is important because the revolution was fought under two basic premises. One was that all people everywhere have a right to consent to those who govern them.
Right.
And the other one is that we should not be taxed. There should be no taxation without representation. Mm. Well, look what happened in the Civil War. When Lincoln came to office, he crushed forever. The consent of the governed argument, because clearly the South, the states that wanted to secede, no longer consented, and he crushed that. So you no longer had the consent of the government; you had a union at the force of arms. So ever since then, we can't even talk about the revolution. That's why the revolution isn't discussed, because not only does Hollywood and everyone else, they don't want to talk about a citizens up in arms and going after their tyrannical leaders, because that might give people ideas today, you know, but might have given their yellow jackets, but they don't want to talk about the concept of the consent of the governed, because clearly that was shattered in the Civil War, and the taxation without representation.
Right.
Anybody that has dealt with their elected representatives, if anyone believes your representative is representing you, although you're paying taxes for it, you're very naive. So we have no taxation. We have no representation for our taxation either.
Oh, even today, you know, they can call it tariffs. They can call it taxes. I'm like, call it what it is. It's another tax. But I often post, we have, you know, taxation without representation. I argue this with my accountant because I don't even want to pay taxes. I'm like, why should I pay tax if the president doesn't pay tax? Why should I pay tax when the government doesn't even listen to me?
And it's obviously it's an absurd system. I mean, just look at all the people that, and not only Donald Trump, who did, he didn't pay taxes several times as a businessman, but he's certainly not alone. I mean, he goes back to Ambrose Bierce, one of my favorite writers, who I used this as an epigraph in Survival of the Richest, when he defined poor as unable to pay taxes. For instance, Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes that far back. And look at Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, allegedly, if you don't count the Rothschilds. Mm-hmm. Amazon paid no taxes last year, so
exactly,
GE did not pay taxes.
And they all got a big tax break and gifts from the big tax break for the rich.
How do you get a tax break when you're already not paying taxes?
I agree. Listen, I don't know if it was you or another guest on my show. You know, there was a very old Amos and Andy show. I don't know if you remember Amos and Andy.
Yeah.
But it was a great show. Of course, they took it off because somehow they deemed it was racist.
Of course.
Even though it was the only show about black people that actual black people were acting in.
Exactly.
But there was one where, I don't know, Amos goes up to Andy. I don't remember. It was so long ago. And it was tax season. And I think, I don't know, Kingfish says to one of them, you know, hey, man, did you get your tax refund? And the guy answers him and then he says, refund? You got a fund to get a refund. And I ain't funded. And you know what? I remember that all these years later. I mean, when was that show out? When I was like 8 years old?
Yeah, and they can't. I don't think it's convenient to say those things are racist, but there's a lot of street sensibility that you see there. There's a lot of, I mean, that statement is profound in a way.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not expressed, but and you get a lot of that kind of street lingo, and I think that's why also they want to stay away from that, because it's just. I mean, lots of people.
Right.
I was a blue collar worker for years, and I worked with people that were way more perceptive than any Harvard graduate you'd talk to. And that's because they hadn't been indoctrinated, they hadn't been brainwashed, and they didn't trust the system. They understood they were getting screwed over. You work around working class people of all colors that are living paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
And they know what's going on. They
Absolutely.
Know the students aren't doing anything. They know the wrong people get promoted, but there's nobody with a public platform to talk for them. So you end up having, you know, these people, these from their ivory towers, these elitists who have never lived outside of lily white neighborhoods.
And, right. Imagine them living on minimum wage.
Exactly, and it's easy for as a concept to say, well, yeah, we ought to raise the minimum wage, but it takes, you know, somebody like Huey Long. That's why I admire him, and I don't talk about some of the other liberals, because Huey Long recognized what needed to be done, and that's what you go after. And even at that time. Now imagine with all the foundations that we've had, you know, going down to the Clinton Foundation, the Gates Foundation, the newer foundations. That's where untold amounts of wealth are. And Huey Long was talking about the early foundations even then.
Right.
You go after all that wealth, you know, and that's because you have to free that money up. I saw you posted something the other day about how much money an individual family could have if the money was split up. We don't even know, because there's so much money
right.
in these foundations. And in my book, you probably haven't gotten to that part of it yet, but I talk a lot about the Reese Commission investigating tax-free foundations in the 1950s and Norman Dodd. Now, of course, that's a right-wing thing. He was considered attacked by liberals, but again, because he was going after foundations that ostensibly seem like they're liberal and they're going after, you know, feel good causes, but if you look at what they're actually doing, I don't know if you've got to that part yet, but
I just finished the 1920s. I'm just about to start the 1930s.
Okay, well, the Reese Commission actually, one of the things they uncovered about World War I is they discovered that the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace. Now, that sounds like a pretty good, so wow, international peace, cool, right? Well, they uncovered the minutes of some meetings prior to World War I. Where the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace was talking about how to get the United States involved in the war in Europe and how to keep it going as long as possible.
Right.
Now, those are the kind of things that you talk about absolute hidden history, because no court historian can explain that. What is a foundation supposedly devoted to peace doing, scheming, conspiring, if you will,
right,
to get us into war? But you find that if you look into it over and on. That's why I've found in investigating all these wars, because they're perpetual wars, going back to the Civil War, the War of the Spanish-American War of 1898, World War One, World War Two, and all the wars, the Korean.
Yeah, we're still. How long have we been stuck in Afghanistan now? 20 years.
Exactly. Yeah, they're just perpetual wars, but the leading liberals of every era, the so-called liberals, the ones that still are called liberals to this day, they all supported every war there.
Of course.
You really had a left-wing anti-war.
Of course. Look at the Democrats and Nancy Pelosi. They had no problem signing off on this budget, which is, you know, mostly a military budget.
Of course. On the rare occasions Donald Trump has tried to do something decent, where he's tried to talk to, whether it's Putin or North Korea or any leader, or pull back from bombing Syria or whatever, then they attack him. Well, you're being wimpy. And when he did bomb Syria, that's when they all said, wow, he's finally acting presidential.
Exactly. Yeah. Even though it was all based on lies, that whole bombing. Donald,
of
we need
course.
To...
Of course, it was ridiculous. But that's in their eyes. Well,
oh,
that's
yeah.
Right, because if you look at how they rank these presidents, there is no, well, there's been really, I don't know what we would even call a peace president. Calvin Coolidge, maybe? I mean,
no, know, nobody I know of. No one I know. Maybe Kennedy was headed that way,
yes,
but they took
Kennedy,
care of him
Kennedy.
Right away.
Yes, but all the others, Jimmy Carter even, there wasn't really any war during his office, but all the rest, the ones that were the most involved in wars are the highest ranked, of course, starting
right.
with Lincoln and FDR.
Exactly. Well, listen, this nation was founded on genocide and war, so it's not surprising to me. Donna, we need to take a short break. When we get back, we're going to talk about more of the same, so stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Maria. I don't often get to talk directly to the listeners here on the Gary Noll Network, but I felt like doing that today. I know a lot of you really enjoy my show, but you might not know that I do 4 shows a week over at my website, maria.net. So if you're loving the show you get to hear on Sunday, come on over to my site and subscribe, because I've got hundreds of hours of great shows on pretty much every topic in the universe. And that, again, is maria.net, M-E-R-I-A.net. And now we can get back to this excellent show. Thanks. Hi, Maria here, and I have a message due to the pressure of the times we're living in. I'm calling on all students and millennials to get the education they need to fight the fascism taking over our world. I've made a special subscription offer for students and for seniors on a limited budget. For just $9.99 a month, you can subscribe and get that education. Over 500 hours of real education that's necessary to understand the world, the problems, and the solutions. Remember, knowledge is power. Together, you can change the world, but to do so, you must be informed of what's really going on and have real facts to support you in your endeavors. It's time for all the grandmothers to take a stand and teach the younger generation what their life could be and how to get there. Help me help you. One person cannot do it alone, and the guidance you seek is right here at www.maria.net, M-E-R-I-A.net. Your generation is the generation we've been waiting for, so let me help you. Thanks for listening. Okay, welcome back to the show. My guest, Donald Jeffries, and I talking about his latest book, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963, The History They Didn't Teach You in School. Reminds me of that 60s song. You know, when I look back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all.
Yeah.
So, my mind always goes back to either music or a movie. You know, you start, and you did mention Ron Paul did the intro to your book, but what was interesting is when I looked at the intro, you had a quote, "I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I'm a conspiracy analyst," and that was a quote by Gore Vidal. Now, for my new listeners, I was lucky enough to interview Gore Vidal before he left the planet. Never come back, Gore. And if you want to listen to that interview, we actually talked about the stolen elections. That's June 24th, 2011. You know, Donald, when I tell people my website is a complete education, I'm not saying it to brag. You know, there's very few people out there that I've ever missed that were worth anything getting on my show.
Oh, that's incredible. Gore Vidal. I'm one of the last. I mean, as a writer, I don't respect a lot of the writers that are, because I think, you know, unfortunately, especially I write a lot of fiction. I'm still trying to get a couple more novels published, but to me, the last great novelist in America was Kurt Vonnegut, and last great writer, a nonfiction writer, I think, is Gore Vidal. And there just aren't many of them out there now, and it's hard because everything's dumbed down.
Exactly. Yeah. But I was so glad to have him on my show, and then I'm reading through your book, and there you go. I said, oh, we hit another one. When you start talking about Eustace Mullins and how Eustace went to see Ezra Pound in prison and then came away with his book, which was banned on the Federal Reserve. Well, lucky me, I got to interview Eustace Mullins too. Okay, so, and listen, I didn't know all that history when I booked these people, okay? Most of the time, I don't even know who they are until I study them. And when I look at, you know, even his nephew, who's a fan of mine on Facebook, he's still thrilled to death that I have those interviews with Eustace in my archives. So there are certain shows that are never going away in my archives unless, you know, unless I end up in a gulag like Daniel Ellsberg said to me when I had him on the show. He's like, I guess I'll see you in the camps, Maria. So that wasn't very encouraging, but I was like, well, at least I'll be with the intelligent people. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, that's what you have, good company at least.
Right, but I mean, there are a lot of conspiracy theorists out there. There's a lot of conspiracy nuts out there that see a conspiracy in everything, okay? And I've tried to warn them through the years that just because it's a false flag doesn't mean people didn't actually die. But these people still wanted to defend their conspiracy all the way to the end, like the Pizzagate crowd or the Flat Earthers. And then they end up getting sued and losing everything they have. Okay, but I tried to warn them because they really, even though some of them I thought were real students of history, they must have forgotten all of that. They checked out their intelligence the minute Trump became president.
Yeah, well, that's, and again, so many people, because... clearly, the Trump. I've likened Trump to Goldstein, you know, from Orwell's 1984, mm-hmm. where he, you know, I'm sure if the listeners out there have read 1984, hopefully you have, because if you haven't, you should.
Right. If you're too lazy, watch the movie. Although I think the movie sucks, but yeah, you still get the general idea, right?
Yeah, it's never been. Yeah, I don't think it's ever really been adequately done as opposed to the book. But it's my favorite book of all time,
And we're living it.
It was the face of the opposition, and of course he was fake. He was false opposition, but the crowd would be worked up into 2 minutes hate when they'd see Goldstein's face and he talking, and Trump just fits that bill. Mm. I mean, you could put his face up there and have him talk, and you could have a two-day hate. Either.
Right. there was so many people you mentioned in this book that I wrote Trump next to the name because I kept saying, well, maybe Trump is this guy reincarnated. But then I said, no, he couldn't have been everybody in this book. Maybe he was. Who knows? But, you know, all the way back when, you know, I always tell people, you know, one of my favorite quotes by Napoleon Bonaparte is that religion was invented to keep the rich, the poor from murdering the rich. But yeah, you've got some really good ones in here, too, where Napoleon had said, what is history but a fable agreed upon?
Right.
And, you know, the people in the UK and people here in America, too, they still have high reverence for Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, after reading your book, they'll have second thoughts on that. Okay. Everybody from, you know, everybody talking way back when, we're talking hundreds of years ago, about the real rulers in Washington being invisible and exercising their power from behind the scenes. Yeah. You know, even all the way Teddy Roosevelt, you know, I did write in the remarks, JFK pretty much said the same thing too. And everybody's talking today about the deep state like it's something new. You know, if you're in politics, you're part of the deep state, maybe outside of the squad, okay?
Yeah, well, that's, and you have, you know, what's past is prologue, and they think, there's so many things you can get by letting, like, look at something like the first false flag in American history that was obvious was the Spanish-American War of 1898, when you had the Maine, the hell of Spain,
right.
William Randolph Hearst. The invention of tabloid journalism, yellow journalism, all that came out of that, where we decided we've crossed so many moral lines in the sand. in our history, but that was a huge line to cross because that was when America, and you get at the behest of people like Teddy Roosevelt, who was an ex, and I take Teddy Roosevelt's credit, he was kind of like John McCain, where he loved war, lusted for war, but actually would walk the walk. He actually would go and fight in it.
Right.
And, you know, and McCain was crazy enough to do that, too, I think. But Roosevelt, he led the charge. So I'll give him a little credit for that.
Now we have a draft dodge and missed a fake bone spurs.
Right. Well, that's what most of them are like, Trump.
Exactly. Armchair warriors. I think that
most of them don't fight in wars. They're chicken hawks. Roosevelt did... But he still, you know, he pushed this theme, and, you know, you can even look at something like the assassination of McKinley. I mean, was there something there? You know, Taylor Caldwell was a great forgotten novelist who wrote The Captains and the Kings. She theorized that McKinley was knocked off because he didn't want to go international. He didn't want to push this this American imperialism, because that started with somebody like Lincoln's dream. Lincoln was the first imperial president. But Teddy Roosevelt and his mindset was the first imperialistic type president who wanted to go and start occupying other countries. And this is what led us, you know, to the Philippines and places like that.
Right. Well, you could go back to the demonization of Thomas Jefferson. But one thing I certainly remember Jefferson said, I certainly can't say it word for word, it was to mind our own business, basically, and what goes on in other countries, and that we can't force democracy or a republic on other countries. But if they came and asked us how our experiment works so well, then we could share it with them.
Right. Well, and that's one of the reasons, you know, I mean, I have, you know, a mixed feelings about George Washington, his farewell address is one thing you never see them talk about, because his farewell address talked about staying out of other countries and talked about not forming any entangling alliances like Israel, perhaps, that we have today, and just having harmonious relations with everyone. And John Quincy Adams talked about, said America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. So this was the mindset, you know, and that's both sides of the political aisle, because Adams and Washington were opposed for somebody like Jefferson. Mm-hmm. They all felt that way. I don't think it entered their mind, because they were trying to break free of they didn't want to be a colony of Britain anymore. So they didn't want to go and make their own colonies, I don't think. They didn't seem to have that mindset. But it wasn't until a little over 100 years later, in 1898, when America started getting the notion that we're going to start colonizing the world and start our own little imperialism, and that's been our foreign policy ever since. And I, as you know, I write a lot in the book about General Smedley Butler, who lots of people know, wrote
Absolutely.
For his racket, and
right.
you know, this wonderful under-recognized hero, and most people don't know how closely connected he was to Huey Long. Huey Long named Smedley Butler as his fictitious Secretary of War in his book, My First Days in the White House, which was posthumously published after he assassinated. Uh-huh. And Butler said it was the greatest honor of his life. And he also, when Long was assassinated, he said, my interest in politics died with Huey Long. And he never was involved anymore. He died relatively young, but he's a forgotten. I mean, the conspiracy people, like us, we love him because of War is a Racket. But I have so many quotes from him about the great fortunes that were made in World War One, and how the boys were marched off and were made to, and this has happened certainly in World War II, was even greater.
Right.
But if you didn't want to fight, you were emasculated. You were called a big wimp. As society looked at you, why isn't your boy over there? You know, that kind of social pressure, and Johnny Gets Your Gun, Doughboys, Uncle Sam, all that stuff came into being.
Right, war bonds and all the rest of it.
Yeah, Bye Bond, Bugs Bunny, Three Stooges, Tarzan, everybody.
Right, and they got Hollywood involved in that, too. Where, you know, not just to raise money for the war, but also use them as spies.
Yeah, they were propagandists. I mean, people like Archibald MacLeish, who was a celebrated poet, became basically the minister of propaganda during the Roosevelt years. And people I loved, Edna St. Vincent Millay is one of my favorite poets. I loved her work.
Trees. But, her poem on trees was my favorite poem of all time.
Oh, just incredible. God, she's just unbelievable. But, she was involved in these propaganda, along with so many other great writers, and it's a shame. And Charlie Chaplin, at the end of The Great Dictator, he broke the fourth wall and turned to the screen and said, we must get involved. We must stop these guys. And, you know, and that's where I think I differentiate myself between most people. I don't like any of the wars. I'm with Benjamin Franklin. I think there's no such thing as a good war or peace. So I analyze the Nazis, and basically the consensus is that, well, that was a good war, and Civil War was a good war, World War II was a good war. Well, people can judge for themselves, because I talk in there about...
There's no such thing as a good war. That's just the way it's sold to us. War is, what did they call it, legalized murder or mass murder?
Exactly. So you're either, there's always a way to avoid it. I mean, going back to the Civil War, I mean, I think I'm the first one to really look up, you know, I thought, you know what... Why did anybody try to prevent this? This is the Civil War, and I don't know if you've got that part, but I wrote about the crass partisanship that existed even then, where you had like Martin Van Buren and Franklin Pierce arguing. It was briefly arguing over who should issue a statement that, you know, we need to do everything we can to stop this Civil War from happening. And they basically couldn't get together because each one of them thought the other one should be the one to do it. Mm. And that was it. And
right.
That's the rest is history. And certainly by the time World War II came around, you had the America First Committee. I write a lot about that. And they were almost all good, upstanding liberals, people like John T. Flynn, whose careers were ruined by Franklin Roosevelt and others because they didn't want a repeat of World War I. They didn't want to lose, you know, hundreds of thousands of more. They didn't want millions to die, as eventually would do. And they were, you know, people like Sinclair Lewis, people like these were people on the left that were involved in the America First. And, of course, the America First movement would later come, certainly when during the Trump campaign, when people hear that now, they just smear and say, oh, you're Nazis. And that they were anything but Nazis. They were people who didn't want us to be involved in another disastrous war because they wanted to say JFK's dad, Joseph Kennedy. If you look at the eloquent statements he put out, and he had every reason to worry, and unfortunately, as he wrote in a letter to somebody later, you know, I paid a pretty heavy price.
Right.
He ended up losing his oldest boy. He lost his oldest daughter and her husband as well. And so these are people they wonder what the cost is, and I don't know when we're going to get sick of war. So there's a theme to this book. It's that I am thoroughly anti-war. I'm not even sure I would have supported the war for independence. I probably would have, but that's the only one, you know?
Right. Well, and then, you know, a lot of that was over taxes, and yet here we are, you know, as of September 1st, we're paying, what, another 25%. To start in October, it's another tariff tax.
Yeah.
So everybody's posting, you know, that he's the Grinch that stole Christmas because we have a moron in office. But sometimes I wonder, you know, is he really this stupid or is he doing it deliberately? Because I've often known that this country would be destroyed from the inside.
Well, I've posted so much on Trump, Marie. I mean, I think he's an actor hired to play a part. I don't think there's any question. I don't think that he could possibly make all those grammatical errors on Twitter. I think that's done on purpose. For whatever reason, to infuriate the people that hate him
and
encourage a lot of the people in the trailer parks that like him because he's like them.
Right, that 30%. That 30%. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, John Wilkes Booth was a better actor. And let's get back to that. For people that were hanging in there on the Lincoln story with Dave McGowan, get this book because it continues what David couldn't. And when I read it, you know, one thing I remembered reading your account of John Wilkes Booth and how he was protected and scurried out of there. And David had posted it and at that time even put pictures on his website. The picture they put out for him on his, you know, most wanted man poster wasn't even John Wilkes Booth. It was a picture of his brother.
Right, exactly. And you know, Dave's work was so influential on me because Dave basically, I don't know where Dave was going with it, but he had me, the way I was thinking, he was almost ensuring that Lincoln wasn't assassinated. It was a false flag thing, and he had me believing it. Because he had a lot of really interesting stuff there, but during the course of writing this book, I've talked to descendants of people like I've talked to John Wilkes Booth's great-great-great-grandniece several times. And, you know, just like I've talked to Meriwether Lewis's great-great-great-grandnephew. And in both cases, those families have been trying to get the bodies exhumed, especially with Booth. Most of
And they can't. That's crazy that they can't. Because if it was Charles Manson, they'd be able to do it.
That. The government is blocking it because they know what happened. The
right, so think about it. They're still covering up crimes that happened 300 years ago. And people were stupid enough to believe Trump before the election when he said he was going to release all the JFK papers. And even some of my JFK experts, they were so happy and kicking their heels. And I said, he's never going to do that. But it amazed me that everybody fell for it, even smart people. And I was like, listen, they're still covering up Lincoln. Okay.
Lincoln, you can get, and I refer to, as you know, throughout the course of the book, court historians. And that was a term invented by Harry Elmer Barnes, who is another classical liberal in the 20th century, who's been forgotten now and was later smeared as a revisionist. And you know, so many of these people, unfortunately, because of the World War II era, are smeared as anti-Semitic because that's where they stray, because it's perceived they're defending Nazis, when people like me, all I'm doing is pointing out the war crimes. And Dresden, maybe the next time we'll talk more about Nuremberg, which I think I'm the first one to criticize maybe in 50, 60 years, and as the kind of so-called justice it was. People like JFK at the time, most people don't realize JFK, in his Profiles in Courage book, one of the chapters was devoted to Robert Taft, one of the last great Republicans, who was very anti-war and who was bitterly opposed to the Nuremberg trials and said, this is a travesty. Mm-hmm. This is, you can't have the victors trying the losers.
And fining them for 60, 70 years. How do you pay damages for losing a war?
Well, most people don't realize it was only a few years ago that Germany stopped paying reparations from World War I.
I know, I was stymied when I saw that in your book.
I mean, that's incredible.
I was like, what?
but again, people just, and they'll say, okay, well, what about the other side of the coin? I said, well, look, I don't have to write about what Germany did or was alleged to have done.
Right.
And again, I'm dubious of all of it, but you can't be dubious of that, because if you question that, you're anti-Semitic. Look, I'm dubious of all. Hitler's the greatest boogeyman ever. They've created some boogeymen, but he's number one. There's nobody close.
Right.
So I'm dubious of all that, because, you know, the stuff they attributed to him, making lamps shades out of human skin and all these things, that just, okay, it's over the top. You know, it sounds very Hollywoodish, but regardless, let's look at what the Nazis' defense at Nuremberg was. All they did is kept pointing out the things I write about in this book, the atrocities the Allies committed. For instance, you know, the bombing of Dresden, where I think they killed 38,000 toddlers alone. And, and this is, you know, this is one of the world's most beautiful cities that had no military value at all. And most people don't know Slaughterhouse 5, Kurt Vonnegut's most famous novel.
I remember that.
Was written as a result of his experiences. He was greatly moved by what happened at Dresden and the atrocities committed by the Allies. So, you know, history is written by the victors. That's another theme of my book, and we must always remember that, is that they're trying to put the best stamp as they can, and they also want to justify these continuing wars. So if somebody like me can go out and dissect the previous wars and show how ridiculous, how unnecessary they were, and that everybody died in vain, because nobody wants to hear that. Most people are not like Cindy Sheehan, my friend, who continues to fight and say, no, my son didn't die for freedom or anything. He died for no reason at all in one of these worthless wars.
I remember
her. Most people prefer to have their son or daughter referred to as a hero and draped coffin and given medals and stuff.
Right.
And so emotions are bought off that way, but some people are stronger, like Cindy Sheehan, but there aren't too many of them. And if you look at the history here, you can see that it's easy to say, you know, Uncle Joe died, you know, he was a hero fighting the Nazis in World War II, but, you know, most of us are more sophisticated than that, or at least that are listening to this show, and we're talking about that they died, as Smedley Butler said, wars are never about enemies, they're always about opportunities for profit.
Absolutely. Sickeningly so. Well, Donald, thank you so much for joining me on short notice, I might add.
Oh, wonderful. Anytime, Maria.
But I was so excited. I was like, oh, God, I have a free day. Let me get Donald on the show.
Anytime. I talk to you anytime, and I really appreciate your support.
Great. We'll absolutely do this again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.
Donald Jeffries, check out his work. All his books are great, especially Survival of the Richest, if you want to know what's really going on and who the enemies are in this country today. But if you bought The Story of History when we were kids, absolutely read this book. It's going to blow your reality, a whole new hole through your reality. But as I continue to say, better to know than not know. Anyway, thanks for listening to the show. Tune in tomorrow, and I'll see you guys then.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.